Page Roman 5. Starting Introduction. She was born a slave. Her mother and father were slaves. So were her grandmother, aunts, and uncles. It was against the law to teach a slave to read and write. Doing so was punishable by heavy fines to the white teacher and bloody floggings that could be fatal to the black lawbreaker. And yet, several years after escaping to the North, Harriet Jacobs penned an autobiography, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, written by herself. The prohibition against slaves learning to read is obvious. In order to convince a people that they were inferior and deny them a sense of self-worth, it was deemed necessary to keep them away from knowledge, away from the written word. Harriet Jacobs, in her narrative, reveals how she refused to be victimized within her own mind, but rather chose to act instead from a steadfast conviction of her own worth, despite allegations to the contrary. Hers is an example worth emulating even in these modern times. The sexual exploitation of female slaves is also revealed in the minute detail, which makes Incidents unique. Of the more than 100 slave narratives published before the Civil War, most were by men, and those written by black women did not touch upon that verboten subject. Harriet deliberately flushed it out of hiding for the benefit of the thousands of women still in bondage, suffering from such abuse. She wrote under a pseudonym, Linda Brent, and chose fictitious names for her true life characters, deeming it kind and considerate to others to pursue this course. Historians have since then connected the dots, determining everyone's identity, but for the most part the names in the narrative are the ones that appear in this introduction. Page Roman 6. Harriet was born in 1813 in Edenton, North Carolina. Her father, Daniel, a respected carpenter, was allowed to manage his own affairs and live with his wife and two children in their own home. Although more privileged than many, it grated on Daniel's independent spirit that he was owned by another mere mortal and had no legal rights as a man, a husband, a father. He attempted to buy his children, whom he loved dearly, but was unsuccessful. Another relative attempting to buy her children's freedom was Harriet's grandmother, a caterer, greatly respected by the white gentry. As a child, she had been freed by her slaveholding father, but was recaptured, and spent the rest of her life saving money to buy her progeny's freedom. A religious woman, she imparted her sense of virtue and morality to Harriet. When her mother died, 6-year-old Harriet and her brother William, 4, were taken away from their father to live with their mother's mistress, further embittering him. The child follows the condition of its mother. That was the tenet of the times, and it would bedevil Harriet for most of her life. In Incidents, she excoriates that tenet for interfering with the natural affinity between parent and child. In her new home, Harriet's kind and benevolent mistress taught her to read and sew. This benevolence, however, did not extend beyond the grave. In her will, mistress bequeathed 11-year-old Harriet to her young niece instead of freeing her, as had been expected. The girl's father, Dr. Flint, became Harriet's master and hated tyrant. By the time she was 14, he was 40 years older. His lewd lust for Harriet became a lifelong obsession to bend her to his will, to force her to submit voluntarily to his sexual demands. Resisting his persecution, Harriet fell in love with a free black carpenter who wanted to marry her. Enraged, Dr. Flint threatened to shoot the nigger and made plans to build a cottage on the outskirts of town to install Harriet as his concubine. She panicked. She despaired of having a child by him, estimating that he already had 11 slave babies. Page Roman 7. These mothers never revealed who the father was except among themselves, fearful of the consequences. Routinely, they were sent far away when their master's lechery turned elsewhere. Harriet had seen several women sold with his babies at their breast. "I wanted to keep myself pure," she wrote. "I tried hard to preserve my self-respect, but I was struggling alone in the powerful grasp of the demon slavery, and the monster proved too strong for me. I felt as if I was forsaken by God and man, as if my efforts must be frustrated, and I became reckless in my despair." In her recklessness, Harriet responded to the advances of Mr. Sands, a white lawyer, hoping that in revenge Dr. Flint would sell her to him. although outraged, he did not. She wrote, "It seemed less degrading to give oneself than to submit to compulsion. There is something akin to freedom in having a lover who has no control over you, except that which he gains by kindness and attachment." She had a son, Ben, and a daughter, Ellen, by the attorney. It is important to note that in choosing the lawyer, Harriet exercised control over her own body, her own life. With Mr. Sands, she experienced love and compassion, a natural human desire, while at the same time thwarting her master's sexual persecution. In this, she was the victor rather than the victim, reinforcing the assertion that success is forming a positive self-image depends upon taking the initiative to participate effectively in one's own development. Harriet also chose her own areas of confinement, her own prison, so to speak, rather than allow herself to be imprisoned by her owner. Dr. Flint threatened to kill her for resisting him, then declared he wanted her happiness and would be lenient. His leniency included knocking her about physically on occasion, and once even sending her crashing down a flight of stairs. He hurled her infant son across the room into a wall, knocking him unconscious. When Dr. Flint threatened to have her children sent to his son's plantation, to be broken in, Harriet fled. For months, she ran from one hideout to another. One step ahead of capture, aided by slaves who risked their lives to hide her, and even a white woman who risked ruin. Page Roman 8. The most revolting and perilous hideout was the Snaky Swamp, a wild, tangled mass of briars and tall bamboos, of refuge for fugitive slaves, mosquitoes, and reptiles. Harriet was glad to escape from there alive and sneak into the hiding place her Uncle Philip, a carpenter, had constructed for her. To Harriet's amazement, this was in her grandmother's house, which was under constant surveillance, and it was ingenious, a dark garret under the shingled roof, 9 feet long and 7 wide, home to only rats and mice, completely undetectable from the outside. The sagacity of Harriet Jacobs should not be underestimated. While surviving in this crawl space for almost 7 years with her supportive family as accomplices, she read and wrote letters, instigated the sale of her children to their father, and ingeniously sent Dr. Flint scurrying to New York in search of her. She is representative of a community of slaves in her immediate vicinity who attempted to escape from the battlefields of war, as Harriet described slavery. The list begins with her own family, her brother, aunts, and uncles. As for the neighbors, an old woman hid her fugitive daughter. A young man escaped from a trader. Another fled from a sexually abusive cripple. A female slave shipped out on a northbound vessel. The relevancy of these incidents indicate that the strong family ties that influenced Harriet and the rebellious activities of neighbors made her contemptuous of the happy darky theory that she would later contest in a published article. Finally, at age 29, Harriet left her garret and was secreted aboard a vessel bound for Philadelphia. And so she joined the fight. It was endemic. Black slaves had always been a troublesome presence, a plague, a danger, rebelling in a variety of ways. They engaged in sabotage, damaging machinery. They set fires, burning down entire neighborhoods. In 1761, the Charleston Gazette reported that Negroes had begun the hellish act of poisoning. It was a female slave who poisoned her master's soup and were hung in the bargain. Male slaves, like Frederick Douglass, physically fought their masters or banded together in slave revolts, such as the one led by Nat Turner. Page Roman 9. And many a thousand ran to the north, to Canada, or to Florida, where they fought with the Indians against Andrew Jackson in the Seminole Wars. The crying need was to breathe in the precious air as a free soul, as Harriet did upon landing in Philadelphia. For the first time in her life, she rhapsodized, "I am standing on free soil." But too soon, Harriet learned, as she was eventually reunited with her children and sought domestic work in New York and Massachusetts, that she could be captured and returned to slavery. Dr. Flint was still traveling north to find her. The entire country joined in the manhunt for runaways with a passage by Congress of the Fugitive Slave Law. It became lucrative in the north for slave catchers to snatch black people, declare that they were fugitive slaves even if they were free, and ship them south into bondage. Any citizen assisting fugitive could be fined and imprisoned. Harriet was working in New York at the time, and during this reign of terror lived in a state of perpetual anxiety. Hard-working black people, who had resided there for 20 years or more, grabbed their children and fled to Canada. Eluding capture, Harriet had many hairbreadth escapes. Her goal was to educate her son and daughter and live in a home with them. But instead, they were forced to scurry about from pillar to post, seeking safety. One of those pillars was her fugitive brother, William, whom she joined in Rochester, New York, where he had opened an anti-slavery reading room. There, Harriet became firmly entrenched in the abolitionist society, residing for 9 months with Isaac Post, a white abolitionist, and his wife, Amy, who became a lifelong friend. Another pillar was the home of Mrs. Bruce in New York, where she worked as a child's nurse. When pursuers again threatened Harriet's safety, Mrs. Bruce, in opposition to her husband, was pro-slavery, sent Harriet into hiding. To the end of the nightmare of constant pursuit, Mrs. Bruce bought Harriet's freedom for $300, without her knowledge. It had to be without her knowledge, for Harriet Jacobs was a woman with a strong moral code, which included not enriching slave owners by buying the freedom of a slave. Page Roman 10. She did not regard herself as property, and therefore should not be bought with a bill of sale. And yet, when the deed was done, she confessed that it lifted a heavy load from her weary shoulders. The full-length narrative, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, ends with Harriet's freedom, but her remarkable life continued. It was her Rochester friend, Amy Post, who suggested she write her life story, which she believed would aid the abolitionist cause. Harriet vacillated. It was one thing to discuss her intimate life with a woman friend, and quite another to go public with it, especially since she felt guilty about her sexual relationship with Attorney Sands. In her letters to Amy Post, and in Incidents, she acknowledged, "I know I did wrong. The painful and humiliating memory will haunt me to my dying day. Still, in looking back, calmly, on the events of my life, I feel that the slave woman ought not to be judged by the same standard as others." With the heroism that marks her life, Harriet refused to allow guilt and shame to deter her from making public the sexual oppression she had endured and the deliberate action she chose to thwart it. She was still working for Mrs. Bruce, who suggested that Harriet Beecher Stowe, the famous author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, might be interested in having Harriet dictate the narrative to her. Many slave narratives were so dictated. Stowe's response was that she was working on A Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, presenting the original facts and documents upon which the story is founded, and some of Harriet's facts could be included therein. Harriet wanted her life story to be a separate history and decided to write it herself, hopeful the book would arouse Northern women to realize how deep and dark and foul is the pit of abominations, chattel slavery. It took Harriet 5 years to accomplish her goal, writing after work and in secret, because her employer, Mr. Bruce, would have objected. Her premonition was correct. He was a defender of slavery, and later wrote an article stating that blacks were happy with their lot. She honed her craft, so to speak, by also writing long anti-slavery articles. Letters from a Fugitive Slave was published in the New York Tribune in June 1853, and Cruelty to Slaves in July 1853. Page Roman 11. Later, Life Among the Contrabands was published in William Lloyd Garrison's journal, The Liberator. When Incidents was finally completed, Harriet traveled to England in vain, hoping to find a publisher. Back in America, a Boston company, Phillips and Samuels, agreed to publish it but went bankrupt before printing. Harriet bought the printing plates, and another Boston firm, Thayer and Eldridge, agreed to publish the narrative if the renowned author, Lydia Maria Child, would write a preface. William C. Nell, a black abolitionist, introduced Harriet to the author, who also agreed to edit the manuscript. What Harriet Jacobs accomplished in Incidents is astounding. She attacked cherished institutions, refusing to accept the status quo, refusing to accept the station in life reserved for her, refusing to accept the denial of her humanity by the powers that be. Those powers itself she called into question. The law declared that although she had fled to the free states, she was still a slave. Harriet regarded such laws as the regulations of robbers who had no rights that I was bound to respect. Aspects of the patriarchal system also came under attack. Harriet linked the sexual exploitation of female slaves with the degradation of Southern white women. Although they were often vindictive and cruel toward the objects of their husbands' lust, nonetheless, the mistress of the house and the female slave alike were subject to the vices imposed upon them by their lord and master. Slavery, Harriet wrote, made those lords cruel and sensual, their sons violent and licentious, their daughters contaminated, and their wives wretched. Slavery corrupted the morals of white families and impoverished black families by denying them control of their own lives and destiny, which was degrading, and by the forced separation of husband and wife, parent and child. Another institution that earned Harriet's scorn was Southern white churches. Denouncing them as unchristian, she insisted that missionaries routinely sent overseas should peer into the dark corners at home and talk to American slaveholders. Tell them it is wrong to traffic in men,